Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi calls for regional cooperation without foreign intervention as he hails Iraq for a planned regional summit. Colombia says it is investigating former rebel group FARC over its alleged recruitment and use of over 18,000 child soldiers. And wildfires kill at least 42 people in Algeria, with authorities blaming arsonists for igniting the flames. Welcome to the program. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says foreign intervention in the region is the source of tensions and poses threats. In a meeting with Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein, Raisi said regional cooperation is a prerequisite for lasting security and peace. The Iranian president also thanked Hussein for Baghdad's invitation of Iran to a regional summit planned for later this month. The Iraqi foreign minister, for his part, said lasting security can only be established in the region with the help of both Tehran and Baghdad. Political commentator Feroz Al-Najim says the U.S. has constantly tried to disrupt the strategic alliance between Iran and Iraq.
I mean, it's a very important strategic countries, Iraq and Iran. And they are very important allies, have always, tried to keep this strong alliance, especially after the Saddam regime fell down. This alliance has always been disrupted because of the American hegemonic system and their, people that are serving their project inside Iraq in different places. And they've always tried to disrupt this unity and the strength of these two countries. Luckily now, with this new government, with President Raisi, he seems that he has a very strong agenda, and he's working very rapidly to build relations between Iraq and Iran, and hopefully for a sovereign Iraq, because as we see, Iraq is not really sovereign. They killed Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian general that was invited to see the prime minister at the time of Iraq. As we see, we're an alliance. Like, Daesh came in, ISIS, this terrorist organization, and invaded a big portion of Iraq, and almost invaded all of Iraq. But Iran was the first country that came in and supported Iraq. And this should be show a sign to anybody that understands that, that Iran is there to support the region. And even they have, had presented an invitation. I know that President Raisi has also reached out to the UAE and other countries in the region, telling them that we should start a new page. We need to build relations together.
Iran has once again rejected the U.S. and U.K. allegations that the Islamic Republic was behind the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. This after Washington and its allies, including Israel, renewed their accusation against Tehran during a UN Security Council meeting on Monday. More in this report.
Iran has once again denied having any link to the recent attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off Oman. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the UN, Zahra Ershadi, dismissed the accusations as politically motivated, saying there is no verifiable and conclusive evidence to substantiate the claim. Ershadi also urged the Council to avoid being trapped by the fabrications of the Israeli regime, which as usual are blindly supported by certain Western countries. The Iranian diplomat responded to renewed accusations by the U.S. and its allies during Security Council meeting. During the virtual session, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken even vowed to punish Iran for the alleged attack. Iran has repeatedly rejected the accusations, warning that it will not hesitate to give a crushing response to any threat against its national security. Chief Commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, also warned Israel not to shorten its life by making a wrong and aggressive move. The Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that Iran is carefully monitoring the suspicious moves by the U.S., the U.K. and Israel in the region.
Such moves are made to create chaos and confusion among countries in the Persian Gulf area. Tehran is ready to neutralize any plot to destabilize the region.
Following the ship incident, resistance sources told a media outlet that the attack was in retaliation for a recent deadly Israeli airstrike on a Syrian airport. But Washington and London have thrown their weight behind Israel in its blame game against Iran while turning a blind eye to Israel's own hostile acts in the region. According to a report by Wall Street Journal, over a dozen of Iranian vessels had fallen victim to the Israeli attacks, some of which openly claimed by the regime. It seems that the West is trying to shift the international attention from Israel's frequent deadly attacks on the Gaza Strip and Syria, as well as its atrocities in the occupied territories. Such a stance will simply embolden Tel Aviv to push ahead with its crimes with impunity. Nonetheless, the ongoing plot against Iran is just exposing the weakness of a regime the U.S. and its Western allies had created in the occupied Palestine. The attack on an Israeli-managed ship and Israel's defeat in its war on Gaza at the hands of resistance groups spotlight the regime's weakness. This also shows the era of hit and run for Israel has come to an end.
The Taliban have captured the capital cities of Baghlan province north of Kabul and the western border province of Farah as the militants continue their rapid advances across that country. A local lawmaker confirmed that the Taliban gained control of the governor's office and police headquarters in the city of Farah. He said the militants entered the city after a brief fight with security forces. The Taliban have captured 8 provincial capitals in less than a week. Meanwhile, Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and a group of political leaders have agreed to form a joint command center to mobilize public uprising forces against Taliban militants. The UN Human Rights Chief has called on the Taliban to cease their military operations and warned of possible war crimes committed during the militant group's offensive. Palestinian factions have denounced Saudi Arabia over its verdict against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians, handing jail terms of up to 22 years. The group was detained in March of 2018 during a wave of arrests by Saudi authorities. Ruba Shabit reports from Gaza.
Saudi Arabia issued sentences against 69 Palestinians and Jordanians residing in the kingdom, with some handed jail terms up to 22 years while acquitting a number of detainees. Among the detainees is Hamas senior member Mohammed al-Khudri, who was sentenced to 15 years. His son was also given a 3-year jail term. Palestinians have slammed the court ruling, saying it follows the Israeli goal of defeating the Palestinian resistance.
This was shocking news for us, as we never expected things would reach this level. They sentenced a national man who is representing his country and works within the law of Saudi Arabia. Mohammed didn't pass the limits, and he was guided and directed by Saudi authorities. It is really sad for us, as they don't have any right to sentence him to this term. This verdict is unjustified.
In February, al-Khudri had a surgery. He was being treated for cancer when Saudi authorities arrested him. Al-Khudri, who has been in charge of working on ties with Saudi Arabia for 2 decades, is now on a wheelchair inside the Saudi jail.
I hope things will be better and we will get our brother and his son released, as he is an old man while his health is deteriorating. He has recently done a surgery for his cancer and he is on wheelchair. I hope Saudi authorities reconsider this ruling and stand by the Palestinians.
Hamas and the Palestinian factions have condemned the sentences, calling them unjust, saying those sentenced had done nothing to harm Saudi Arabia. Hamas also welcomed the acquittal of some of the detainees and called on Saudi authorities to quickly release them.
We
totally condemn this decision and reject the ruling against our sons in Saudi Arabia, and we consider them political prosecutions. Saudi Arabia doesn't have the right to sentence those people who didn't commit any offense against the kingdom and its people. This is an unjust decision, as Saudi Arabia has always supported Palestinians, but now it is trying to satisfy the U.S. and Israel. We call on Saudi authorities to release those detainees.
Palestinians here say the Israeli move further sows relations between the Palestinian nation and Saudi Arabia, calling on Riyadh to release those detainees as they have caused no harm and not committed any offense. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Colombia says it's investigating former rebel group FARC over its alleged recruitment and use of over 18,000 child soldiers. A special court said nearly 5,700 of the children were aged 14 or younger. The tribunal added that it's also probing possible crimes and atrocities committed during the group's guerrilla fight against the state, which began from 1964. Authorities have called 26 former FARC members to testify on the events. The group signed a peace treaty with the Colombian government in 2016 to end decades of violence. And the U.S. embattled New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has announced his resignation amid sexual harassment allegations against him. In a televised address, Cuomo said he accepted full responsibility and apologized to any woman he said may have been offended by his actions. He, however, defended his conduct and denied sexual harassment allegations, adding that he did not realize the extent to which the line had been redrawn. Cuomo said his resignation would take effect in 14 days. Last week, a report by the New York Attorney General's office found that Cuomo engaged in sexual harassment of 11 women. With Cuomo leaving office, Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul will become New York State's first female governor. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan believes Andrew Cuomo had become a spent force for the Democratic Party and had to resign under pressure.
The pressure was mounting on Andrew Cuomo as governor. All the top Democrats, Biden, Nancy Pelosi, were calling for him to resign. And this allows him a dignified exit, and also says it's better for the state that he would resign gracefully and not fight the impeachment proceedings, which would be very distracting and, of course, not helping the state of New York. So they do have a lieutenant governor, a woman, who's going to be the first female governor of New York State, and she's not considered a major player or insider, but she does have a good reputation, and she's done a lot of good outreach in the state of New York, so she will be popular. And this allows her to get established before the next election, which will come up, I believe, next year. So she'll be in a much better position, and it'll give the Democrats a chance to distance themselves from Andrew Cuomo's record on sexual harassment. We may not have heard the last of Andrew Cuomo, but certainly right now, is damaged goods, and it's wise for him to step down for the benefit of New York State and, of course, the Democratic Party in the United States.
Forest fires in Algeria have killed 42 people, including 25 soldiers who were deployed to help put out the inferno. The defense ministry said more soldiers had been badly injured with burns. Dozens of fires have been ravaging forests 100 kilometers east of the capital, Algiers, in the Kabylie region, where there are some difficult-to-access villages. Authorities said the simultaneous outbreak of many fires in the same location suggests that arsonists were behind igniting the flames. Last week, a European Union atmosphere monitor said the Mediterranean has become a wildfire hotspot as massive blazes engulfed forests in Turkey and Greece, aided by heat waves. The United States hails Egypt as a constructive defense partner as Washington considers new military aid to Cairo. At a Senate hearing, State Department and Pentagon officials defended security assistance to Egypt as a critical tool for the Arab country to address its security concerns. U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged no more, quote, blank checks to Cairo due to brutal crackdown on critics. But Washington is considering whether to release $300 million in military aid that Congress has linked to human rights standards. Human rights groups have been urging Biden to exert pressure on Cairo by cutting military aid. The U.S. has been sending $1.3 billion in annual security aid to Egypt. Shia Muslims in Iran and across the world have marked the beginning of commemoration ceremonies in honor of the third Shia Imam, Hussein ibn Ali. In Tehran, a symbolic flag-waving ceremony has been held to kickstart the 10-day-long tradition. Youssef Jalali reports.
This black flag was waved high on Tehran's sky in honor of a man who has inspired Muslims for more than 13 centuries, Imam Hussein. This symbolic ceremony marked the beginning of an annual tradition that commemorates the third Imam of Shia Muslims and mourns his tragic martyrdom at the hands of the cruel ruler of the time.
This is the fourth consecutive year that we at the Abbasabad Hills complex raised the symbolic flag of Imam Hussein over the city of Tehran to ring in the 10-day Muharram ceremonies. This is the tallest flagpole in the Middle East, measuring 150 meters in height, so it can be seen from many neighborhoods in Tehran.
Every year on Imam Hussein's martyrdom anniversary, Shia Muslims in Iran and across the world take part in mass mourning processions for 10 days, starting on the first day of the lunar month of Muharram. For the second year now, the ceremonies have been largely limited because of the coronavirus pandemic. Tehran City Council says it has restricted this year's ceremonies to open-air venues with smaller numbers of people.
We plan to hold a safe Muharram this year. Mourners are obliged to observe health protocols. Imam Hussein commemoration is a tradition that has been around for centuries, but what's important is the ideology of Imam Hussein that should be preserved, and our people need to be cautious and not hold the processions in large numbers.
Imam Hussein and 72 of his companions were killed in Karbala in 680 AD after they refused to pay allegiance to then Umayyad ruler Yazid ibn Muawiyah. Islamic references have it that Yazid diverted Islam from the true version that was introduced by Prophet Muhammad. Being the Prophet's grandson, Imam Hussein tried to revive the true Islam by resisting against Yazid. For centuries, Imam Hussein has taught lessons of freedom to millions of people across generations through the annual commemoration ceremonies. This is the second year that mourning processions have been curtailed amid the coronavirus pandemic. But Muslims say his legacy is here to stay. Youssef Jalali, Tehran.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. UK government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier barracks or large hotels." We'll prepare for you an article written jointly by Diane Taylor and Mark Townsend. The piece is titled, UK Home Office Records 70 Racist Incidents by Far Right at Asylum Accommodation. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. According to a Freedom of Information response obtained by The Guardian, the UK Home Office has recorded 70 racist incidents by far-right supporters against asylum seekers in barracks and hotel accommodation. However, campaigners supporting asylum seekers in such accommodation say the figure is a significant underestimation of the true picture. The data, which covers 1st of January 2020 until 13th of July this year, involves incidents in the much-maligned Napier and Penali barracks, which have been under intense scrutiny by MPs after their untenable conditions were revealed, as well as a large-scale COVID outbreak in the former. Penally Barracks in Pembrokeshire, Wales, was closed in March, despite only being opened in September of 2020, along with Napier in Folkestone, Kent. Hotels have been used throughout the period, but their use for asylum seekers increased sharply after the start of the COVID pandemic in March of 2020. In Napier Barracks, 4 incidents were recorded between September and December of 2020, with 12 occurring so far this year. This is despite the barracks being temporarily emptied in April after the coronavirus outbreak. There are now thought to be 176 asylum seekers living there. Several incidents at Penally Barracks was reported to the Home Office last year, and many in 2021. Witness statements from legal challengers by asylum seekers living there reveal a catalogue of disturbing episodes, including an attempt to ram a refugee with a car. Others include stones and bottles being thrown, rape threats, attempts to start fights, fireworks shot through the gate, and eggings. According to witness statements, a farm shop in the area said some of the far-right supporters had asked to buy pigeon scarers to mimic the sound of gunfire and frightened asylum seekers. The number of incidents recorded in hotels has tripled this year, with 40 examples reported, up from 13 last year. Saturday, 7th of August, the far-right organisation Britain First posted a video on its website headlined "Britain First Exposes an Illegal Immigrant Hotel in Hull," in which members of the organisation say they posed as journalists to confront asylum seekers. One asylum seeker from Yemen experienced 2 incidents involving far-right protesters at his Home Office-provided hotel on the outskirts of London. He said, "They were driving around the hotel recording us on video," adding, "They were insulting us, swearing at us, and screaming things like, 'Go out from our country. Why are you eating our food? Go away from us. You are strangers here.' We were too scared to go outside the hotel and felt like it was a prison. We had to stay inside." He added, "We fled countries where there is war and destruction and felt safe when we arrived here. But when we saw this kind of racist attack, we felt we were not protected." Maddie Harris of Humans for Rights Network said, "Ghettoizing people seeking safety in large-scale accommodation such as hotels and army barracks exposes them to harm. The figures shown here are not an accurate representation of the level of racial abuse endured by the people we support. We have had numerous conversations with asylum seekers where they have told us how unsafe they feel due to frequent incidents of racial abuse and that they have experienced in and around these accommodations." Claire Mosley, the founder of Care for Calais, said, "Targeting vulnerable asylum seekers is an act of extreme cowardice. Our government must support people seeking asylum to integrate into our communities rather than putting them in places like Napier Barracks or large hotels." The Home Office spokesperson said, "It is unacceptable for anyone in asylum accommodation to experience hostile or racist incidents, and we ensure each incident is thoroughly investigated. We work closely with a range of organizations to ensure immediate support and assistance is provided to people living in the accommodation, and if needed, escalate to law enforcement." Meanwhile, European citizens who have applied for settled status are being detained and threatened with deportation, a development that contradicts assurances from ministers and appears to contravene the Brexit withdrawal agreement. The Home Office has served European Union nationals with removal directions, even though the they could prove they had applied for settled status, which would protect their rights to remain in the United Kingdom. Ministers have repeatedly promised that anyone who had applied by the 30th of June deadline would have their existing rights protected while their case was being heard. The apparent failure to honour the agreement has prompted accusations of either administrative incompetence by the Home Office officials or a willful attempt to deport as many European Union nationals as possible, on the assumption they're easier to remove, for instance, than asylum seekers. A letter from the legal charity Bail for Immigration Detainees to the head of Immigration Enforcement, dated 29th of July, raises concerns over the Home Office's failure to acknowledge receipt of settled status applications in cases where it wants to deport European Union citizens. Bail for Immigration Detainees says that unless a meaningful response is received from the Home Office, it will make an official complaint to the European Commission. Lawyers argue it marks an important battle to protect the rights of European Union nationals following Brexit. They warn that the failure to acknowledge applications could potentially affect thousands of individuals. Recently, an EU citizen from the Home Office wanted to deport and who had been detained in an immigration removal centre secured their release on bail after a judge accepted that they could not be removed because they had made an European Union Settlement Scheme application. Even so, the Home Office still contested their release and offered no apology or explanation why it had earlier argued there was no evidence of the application at a previous hearing and therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national who requested anonymity told The Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McClough, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain European Union nationals, perhaps believing that they're easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures. The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of being forwarded digitally." Aranea Kogolathos, a barrister and legal manager of BIDS EEA, European Economic Area Project, said, "Paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison, who found it difficult to access computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals." Barrister Aranea Kogolathos said, "Despite having made the European Union Settlement Scheme applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation."
Food for thought.
Salam, and today on the start of the morning month of Muharram, we start the day by pondering upon a wise saying from the immortal martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. Whoever uses symbolism in religious matters will always remain in confusion, deviated as he stumbles off the right path, sticking to deviation wherever he goes, straying off the right course, and saying bad and worthless things.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanted whisper.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio and the program Islamic Laws, in which we are going to talk about the rules and fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei, which are related to the month of Muharram and mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Before everything, let me express my condolences to the Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, and all the Muslims all around the world, especially the Shias, on this being the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Like always, we are joined by our dear guest, Sheikh Javid. Sheikh Javid, salamu alaikum, and thank you for accepting our invitation.
Salamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on this program.
So as I mentioned, today we will answer to the questions asked from the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, but before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
Thank you. little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid, according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Welcome back. You are listening to the Islamic Laws and a special issue for the month of Muharram. And the first question that is asked from the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, is as follows. Sheikh Javid, the question is that, what is the Islamic law about fasting on the 9th and 10th of Muharram? We know that in some of the Islamic countries, especially among some of our Sunni brothers and sisters, they have this impression and viewpoint that it might be encouraged and recommended for the people to fast, especially on the 10th of Muharram, that is the day of Ashura. So what is the fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei in this regard?
Well, as you rightly mentioned, there are some people who believe that fasting on the 10th day of Muharram as well as on the 9th of the same month is encouraged. But these are some Sunni Muslims who believe that fasting on these days is especially recommended based on their riwayat, based on their traditions, and of course on the verdicts of their own scholars. But of course, our scholars and our fuqaha have their own special opinions regarding this special occasion and fasting on these 2 days, especially the 10th day of Muharram, because it's in a special occasion in the lunar calendar. Well, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, fasting on this day is not haram. Unlike some people who believe that fasting on the 10th day of Muharram is forbidden, but all of the Shia religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and Grand Ayatollah Sistani, are of the view that fasting on this day, especially on this day, the 10th of Muharram, is not forbidden, but it is better for Shia Muslims who observe Muharram to break their fast, if they ever intend to fast, to break their fast by eating or drinking something. And of course, it is makruh. Generally speaking, it's makruh to fast on this day.
We're talking about the cases in which there is no like qasam or nazr, vowing and swearing to, for example, fast on that day.
That's an exception, of course. Mm-hmm. If you make a vow, or if you make a pledge that you will fast on this day, there's no objection to you. You can fast on this day.
And the other question is that when it comes to the acts of worship and recommended actions, like recommended prayers and fastings, I've heard that when we say that it is, for example, makruh or discouraged to fast on this day, it doesn't mean that it's better to leave it. Rather, it may mean that it has less reward compared to those actions done in other days of the year. Is it the same in this regard as well?
You're right. Of course, makruh in this context means that there is less reward. Of course, for example, if you are offering prayers and you are wearing black dresses or black garment, yes?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean that, okay, your prayer is totally discouraged, there's no reward in that prayer, and that you are just simply relieved of the obligation. No, there is sawab because you are complying with God's order, you are fulfilling your obligations with the intention, getting proximity to Allah and closeness to God. You will earn the sawab, but of course there will be less sawab, there will be less reward.
I see.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? Millions of angels, I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me.
The next question is about wearing black clothes during the month of Muharram. We know that it's a culture, I believe, among all the Shias all around the world to show the fact that they are sad for this occasion, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. They wear black, maybe some people only on the 9th and 10th days of Muharram, some people for 10 days or even more, the whole month of Muharram. Now, the question is that, is it also makruh or, discouraged for the people who are mourning for Imam Hussein alayhi salam to offer their prayers while they are wearing full black clothes during the month of Muharram or Safar or in other occasions like the martyrdom anniversaries of the Imams, when the Shia are mourning for the Imams?
It is not makruh to be very brief. It's not makruh according to all religious authorities, including Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, to wear full black, okay,
mm-hmm.
during Muharram, of course, and during Safar, or when there is a sad occasion like the martyrdom anniversary of one of the imams. So if the intention is, of course, to honor that and that occasion and to wear full black as a sign of commemorating that event and or as a sign of respecting that event, because actually وَمَن يُعَظِّمْ شَعَائِرَ اللَّهِ فَإِنَّهَا مِنْ تَقْوَى الْقُلُوبِ, and whoever of course respects the signs or the rites of Allah, then he is among those people who respect and God's actually
they are practicing piety, of course,
among those people who observe piety. So in fact wearing black is a sign of respecting that sha'air, that sign, that divine sign, or that religious ritual. And
I believe it's not something new among Shia communities. Maybe some people consider it as a matter of culture, but I believe there are some cases in the history of Islam and even early history of Islam which tell us that some people, to show the fact that they are sad for some sad occasions, they have been wearing black clothes. Maybe there is no authentic narration to tell us that it is recommended to wear black, but as you mentioned, the reason people are wearing black is to show their sadness. But my point is that maybe we cannot claim it a kind of new innovation by the Shia. It's been there in the even early days of Islam as well.
Of course, Shia scholars and Shia Muslims have been wearing black because wearing black has been considered as a sign of commemorating a sad day, like the day of Muharram and the day of the martyrdom of one of the infallible imams. And of course it is recognized as a sign of showing grief, a sign of showing sympathy with the family of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. So
so going back to the main question, is it makruh?
The main question, to give you an answer in brief, it's not makruh to wear full black, okay? Full black means covering, wearing all the garments in black, okay?
All the garments,
The shirts and the trousers are black. Okay, if your shirt is black, and your trousers are white, it's not makruh, mm-hmm. even on any other ordinary days.
It's not makruh
because you're not wearing full black, because mm-hmm. your trousers are white, or maybe your trousers are black but your shirt is white, okay, or it's blue. So it's not makruh in that case, even if it's not a sad occasion like Muharram.
So what you mean during for the prayer, it's not makruh?
It's not makruh.
So what about the full black for the prayer?
Full black, of course, on ordinary days, it is makruh to wear full black. But if it is a sad occasion like Muharram and Safar, and your intention is to actually
show your love,
to show your love and sympathy, and to show your grief and sorrow for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam, then it's not, it's no longer considered to be disapproved or disliked or makruh.
I see. Sheikh Javid, unfortunately we are running out of time. Again, I would like to thank you for your presence in this program. And again, I would like to express my condolences for these sad days of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and family members. Inshallah, we'll continue answering these questions in the following session. Till then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it awaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bread. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message when you passed through arid sands meant for in a
the light.
Artists in an Egyptian village work hard to keep alive the ancient tradition of making papyrus paper despite a tourist downturn amid the coronavirus pandemic. The village of Keramis in northeastern Cairo is the largest hub of papyrus production in the country. Many of the residents of the village are involved in farming, processing, and decorating papyrus planted in 25 farms near the village. The Pharaonic era tradition includes cutting strips from the plant, pressing them together, and drying them to form a sheet. The artists then decorate the papyrus to create beautiful products for tourists. However, their industry has been affected by the coronavirus pandemic, forcing the artist to use more creativity.
We are trying to think out of the box to keep this profession alive. We make products out of papyrus paper, like wallets, notebooks, drawing sketches, new products, so we can keep going.
The artists have also launched online stores to sell their new products. Papyrus producers say they have lost nearly 80% of their income in the last 2 years. However, they say they will never stop making papyrus and will make every effort to keep the ancient cultural tradition alive. Prehistoric cave paintings found in Spain prove that Neanderthals were the first artists on Earth. A new study says red markings discovered in three caves near Malaga did not occur naturally. They were made by Neanderthals nearly 65,000 years ago. That's when modern humans did not inhabit the continent yet. The findings suggest that the pigments were applied at different times, sometimes more than 10,000 years apart. This shows that Neanderthals returned to the site over time to make symbolic markings.
I believe that this art made by the Neanderthals will be also found in other caves around the world. This time figurative art, which we have not paid attention to, may be precisely the oldest art in the world. So this place in Spain is one of the caves with the oldest art in the world.
Researchers say the pigments are yet another evidence that the intellectual capabilities of Neanderthals have been underestimated. Neanderthals went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
Egypt's forgotten art of Batik is undergoing a revival thanks to a designer who has been working hard to bring the ancient cloth decorating technique to life. Working tirelessly in a small workshop in Old Cairo, Samer Hassanyan has enhanced the art of batik over the years. Samer is one of the few designers in Egypt to use the traditional method to design on fabrics. The art consists of patterns created by applying melted wax onto cloth before dipping it in dye or painting over it with a brush. The fabric is put into boiling water in order to melt the wax. The ancient Egyptians used the batik fabric mostly to wrap the coffins and mummies. However, the difficulty of mastering the art caused its disappearance.
Batik has disappeared in Egypt because no one shared their skill. As a teacher, I find that it is very important to provide as much training as I can because people realize how difficult it is when they start learning the techniques.
Samer has now skillful artists in her workshop who design colorful fabric using the technique. Samer says her goal is to produce unique designs that are particularly identified as to Egyptian and represent the country's rich cultural heritage. You
can find tin boxes in every house, with people often throwing them away after consuming what they had inside. But an old lady in Belgium has turned it into her obsession, an obsession for years to fill her home with these fascinating containers. 83-year-old Madame Dardenne has gathered around 60,000 vintage tin boxes in a span of 30 years. The empty containers of all sizes now occupy four other houses. They once used to hold all kinds of goods, ranging from coffee, biscuits, tobacco, tea and soap to shoe polish, are now piled high all over the building that belongs to Dardenne. Some of these boxes, according to her, come from as far as India and Japan. Dardenne says it all started with a chocolate box that was given to her with a painting of a blonde girl in a blue hat.
I consider this box to be the first of my collection. It is a box of Belgian Côte d'Or chocolates that a relative of my husband gave me, believing that I was interested in boxes.
She sees the boxes as history books with decorations and writings on them describing major events and reflecting contemporary culture. The collection is the largest in the world, listed by the Guinness Book of Records. Located in eastern Belgium, the museum can be visited by appointment. Humans have damaged the environment perhaps more than any other species, but there are always some who go out of their way to help animals in distress. Juan Carlos Rodriguez and his wife run a sloth rescue center in the lush outskirts of the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They have so far saved over 45 sloths. The couple decided to start helping the furry mammals last year after running into a sloth that had been badly injured. They saved him and called him Chewie, after a character in the popular Star Wars franchise. Juan and his wife are now alone in their life-saving journey. Sorry, are not alone in their life-saving journey, as their vet friends also help them with services and donations. The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted lives all around the world, but it's important to try to stay fit for humans and animals alike. Penguins in an open zoo in Thailand have been keeping their daily routines, although no visitors are allowed due to COVID-19 restrictions. They are regularly taken out of their air-conditioned enclosure so they can enjoy a walk or swim. The 41 flightless birds consume nearly 25 kilograms of fresh fish each day. The cute animals at the zoo are aged from 1 month to 18 years old.
The Light is a short bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields, like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
South Korean medical workers manning drive-through coronavirus testing centers have a new way to cool off and rest amid hot summer days. Recovery buses. The medical workers are now able to enjoy their breaks at these buses, which are equipped with air conditioning, cold water, and snacks. The workers are allowed to take off their protective suits that trap heat and create an environment difficult to tolerate. Some of the buses also have shower booths and bunk beds to help the medical workers deal with their hard work. They say the buses are refreshing.
I almost feel like I'm stuck in a heat dome, like in a car with the air conditioner off in the middle of summer. It's so hot that it's even hard to breathe. But when I come here during the break time and rest in a much cooler and more pleasant environment like an igloo, I can recharge and work cheerfully in the afternoon.
These buses were first designed and used as resting places for Korean police officers and firefighters. Now, 22 of them are deployed to testing centers across the country. The government is